Hey, welcome to the Skeptic Hangout, the place where we sit back, relax, and chit chat about intriguing and sometimes controversial topics through the lens of skepticism. Today, the old crew is back together. So we are Richard, and Laura. Unfortunately, Josh will not be able to join us, but the silver lining is that we get to spend some time back in the good old days. We will be discussing social class. So depending on where you fall on the social ladder, grab your English tea, your swanky caramel macchiato, or if you're like me, your teeny little can of soda, and join us as we attempt to stratify the social stratification that separates all of us from the top 1% all the way down to the bottom 99. This is Skeptic Hangout, Social Class. Dude, I like forgot to breathe through that whole introduction. I don't know what my like I normally don't hold my breath, but I was like, whoa, what's going on here? All right, so social class. That's an interesting one to me because I think of it more in terms of concept versus like how it's applied in society. So I'm curious where you guys want to go with it.
Well, we're from Britain, so we I think it's a big thing here. Depending on kind of personally, it's something that's never really bothered me, but from where I'm from, it's a very big thing. And working class, and which is the area I'm from, is very, very much a thing to be proud of. I'm guessing by the way Gil's nodding his head along, he's kind of feeling the same. And there is a big st I think there is a big stigma about it. I've been very lucky that I've met people of all the classes. And I don't mean lucky that I've met people who are better than me, air quotes. What I mean is I'm very lucky that I've had the experience of meeting lots of different people.
Can I just butt in? Are you allowed to just say air quotes without doing air
Sorry,
quotes?
the air quotes.
I know.
I
I
was
say
very
quote
conscious of
unquote.
our radio listeners, rather than the viewers. I've met people of all the three classes: the middle class, working class, and the upper class. And I get on fine with all of them. I've only ever had one problem. One instance, which I'll tell you about in a bit, but I've only ever had one instance where I've thought that has made a difference. And in every other respect, I've never had any kind of issues at whatsoever with them.
So I was just looking at Laura's face when you said the three classes, working class, middle class, and upper class. And I'm assuming, therefore, Laura, that there's some difference across the pond in terms of like terminology for classes within
No, there
society.
isn't. It was the way he said it because he said middle class, working class, upper class, which put working class sort of a step above middle class if you're kind of going in like a stratified order. And I was like, well, no, wait a second. How is your middle class your lower class?
No,
Right.
it's not. I
And
wasn't
I
doing it in order.
realized, yeah. And
I
I
was
realized
mixing it up
after a
a bit,
second, I was
keeping
like,
it interesting.
oh, you're keeping me on my toes. So it did. It confused me for a second. But I like that terminology better because we tend to call classes like almost derogatorily, like lower class and upper class. And upper class tends to be just as derogatory as lower class for a lot of middle class people, just because they're I the way that people view people outside their own class system. But I like working class better than calling them lower class, because I think that it describes them more accurately without making their status somehow less than the middle class, if that makes sense.
I think as well that we think traditionally in Britain of working class, middle class, and upper class as being like the three set classes. But I think nowadays those sort of terms are not necessarily the most accurate in terms of representing what modern Britain is like. So, like traditionally, I guess me having gone through university and I'm now a teacher and doing all those other things, like technically in the past probably would have put me in the middle class bracket, but then I also certainly don't see myself as middle class because I was certainly brought up in a working class. You know, my dad worked in a foundry, my mum's a cleaner. You know, I was brought up in a working class family, in a working class household, and I feel like my values are those of working class values. But I also have been to university and done all those other things. You know, I don't fit the traditional sort of description of what like job a working class person would do. You know, I don't work in a factory. I don't work doing anything manual whatsoever. I avoid anything manual if I ever have the opportunity to do so. But so, and I mean, I don't know if there's necessarily like more up to date descriptions of what the class. I guess it's less. I think the point I'm making is that nowadays the class that you are is kind of a bit more fluid, or the classes are not as quite, you know, strictly like, yes, you are definitely working class, yes, you are definitely middle class. But yeah, certainly going back to what Jillifer was saying, there is a big, I think, pride in people who do class themselves as being working class. There is a big pride in that, and actually people can use the word middle class or upper class in a derogatory fashion. And I guess people in those air quotes, and I'm doing them in real life as well, saying air quotes, higher classes might use working class derogatorily. I'm not sure, but
I would agree with you that I think they're more fluid, and I think I fall into the same or similar category as you, is in that, you know, my wife's a teacher, I'm a manager at Royal Mail, and I'm currently at university, and I'm not a traditionally a. But I grew up, my dad was a bus driver and my mum was a higher education teacher. And that was something that came on like later in her life. She retrained and did that. And I think it is a little bit more fluid now. I think there's a lot more, crossover between working class and middle class now. Than they used to be, I find that a bizarre system anyway, because I think most middle class people do work. I think the boundary between middle class and upper class is probably more traditionally rigid as it was, yeah, rather than the other boundary. I'm sure Richard grew up and with me and saw the. I don't know if it was a David Frost or Do Not Adjust Your Set. I think Do Not Adjust Your Set was more kiddie orientated. So I think it must have been David Frost's sketch with John Cleese and Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett up. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Corbett, where they had a very big disparity in height. If you've not seen the sketch, good. And the kind of the tall one was the upper class one. And he looked down on the middle class one, who was the middle sized one, and he looked down on the lower class one, who was Ronnie Corbin, who was very, very short. And so it kind of was a visual representation of it. And that was, I think, late '60s. It must have been late '60s because it was before Monty Python, and that started in 69. So I'm getting around 67, 68 time, maybe a little earlier. And I think that stayed in place quite rigidly until the kind of Thatcher era. And in the Thatcher era, that you know, class became a real big thing in Britain, and was, you know, emphasized a lot, especially your working classness.
I think interestingly, I think class has been significant throughout cultures ever since cultures started moving from like the hunter gatherer and small settlements into big cities, and then basically countries. Social classes have never really not been a big deal as far as I've looked back or ever studied historically. Like, as soon as we started stratifying people into classes, those classes meant something and they were a big deal. I think the level of respect may change from culture to culture and from time to time. Today, they're almost like, it's almost as though the lower classes that are doing the producing and making the things and keeping our civilization and our economies running, those are the ones that are looked down upon the most, which to me is kind of bass ackwards. But I don't know. I just think it's interesting that you said that, like, it became more important. I'm wondering if it kind of goes in and out of our social consciousness, right? Like, whether or not we emphasize class or care about class. But I wonder if that's almost like a middle class problem, like if the lower and upper classes never really lose sight of that. I'm just curious. I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts?
I often see things through, obviously, well, everyone sees things through their own lens, don't they? You know, looking at the world and looking at things that happen. And I think about things that I see taking place in Britain at the moment, where we've got like loads of people on strike, for example, like across the country in various different sectors. On the date of recording, barristers have just said they're going to go into a never-ending strike to do with pay. Trains have been on and off on strike for the last few weeks and months to do with their terms and conditions of work. Those are just naming a few. And I often think about how all of these things are working class people standing up for their rights against the people who have power over them. But nowadays, I don't know if it's necessarily that the working class people are standing up and defending their rights against the upper class necessarily, because I think often it's not really the upper class which are in play. I don't know if that makes sense. So, you know, at one time it would always have been the upper class in terms of like it would have been the big landowner, or it'd have been the Duke of somewhere, or the whatever else, you know, the traditional sort of aristocracy in the UK, which isn't really a thing in the US. But certainly, I can't remember, what was your question?
Well, just that Gilliver had made the comment about how that that class became more important in Britain, like what during the 70s or the 60s, like it was more like they were focused more on it, and I'm curious about that because when I look back in history, it just seems to me that class is always a part of the narrative. It's always like a significant part of either the problem or the solution to a culture's success.
I don't think it. I don't think it came to prominence in the 70s. I think it has always been there. I think I was referring to kind of my memory of the way things were, and how that has changed, how it has changed now from then. I don't think it was kind of a peak then,
Would you
if
possibly
you
argue
like.
that over the sort of the early 2000s and in that sort, I mean, I was only young then, so my memory isn't quite as politically astute as it is for sort of, you know, later time. But could you argue that sort of class felt as if it was less important in that time? And to me, it seems to be more important now. Like people are having to once again, as working class people, fight for their rights, fight for, you know, basic sort of protections as workers and things like that, whereas that really
I
hasn't
think
been
it's
as big a thing.
possible that and just as an aside before I say this, I was listening to an economist
Economist.
recently who said that kind of you do get kind of peaks and troughs of industrial action over like a X amount of year period, and we're kind of coming into one of those peaks now. But I think that, and this is just me thinking on the fly, this is, I've done no analysis on this whatsoever and wouldn't know how to. I wonder if we've moved from kind of a time in the 70s and like leading into the 80s and before that, where class was very much linked to the political party you were in. So if you were a conservative, you were more likely to be of upper middle class or upper class persuasion, and if you were a Labour man, you would come from a traditional working background. And I think that's changed now, and I think on both sides you can have you've got a mixture of people from different backgrounds. You've got, as you know, quite a few kind of publicly educated upper middle class and upper class people in the Labour Party, and I think it's more, I feel that it's more kind of leans more towards political ideology now, class, rather than class proper, and to what class you're born into. I don't know what your guys' opinions are on that.
That's interesting because I've always seen class as being really intimately linked with income. And I do like it fascinates me. It's something that like I think I would have to think more on, but to point out the link between one's political persuasions and one's social class, because I agree with you. I think that traditionally the roles were that the more conservative people were the ones that were kind of really set in middle class, maybe upper middle class, who have a good grounding of their economic status, and that plays into every facet of their life. And then the more liberal ones were the ones that were more lower class and more struggling, like, hey, you guys don't even know what it's like for us, right? And so there was sort of more of a stratification there, both politically and economically. And I'm wondering, and again, this is also just meanderings off the top of my head, I'm wondering if that has a lot to do with social media and the internet and how people of all classes now are sort of all getting this barrage of the same types of information, accurate or inaccurate, right? All at once. And so we're able to digest information outside of sort of our clique. And I know that kind of sounds weird, but I'm wondering where the play of social media and internet comes into this now, like, melting pot of political ideas versus economic statuses and less stratification, or if it's even just perceived versus real. Like, if there is still a pretty significant stratification, but you're now seeing the few that belong to a political party that maybe goes against what their social status would have predicted. Yeah. Maybe they're more visible now because of the internet and social media, whereas they were still there before, just in smaller, more obscure numbers. But that's a fascinating question.
I'm going to start talking and hope that what I end up saying addresses some of what you just said. So, as always, it's interesting because I always think, you know, like Jillifer, you were saying, traditionally in the UK, we have loads and loads of political parties, but the two big players are the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. Labour Party, obviously, Labour Party was founded by basically trade unions wanting to have more political power, and it you know, went from there and became obviously a really influential political party, which has been in government quite a lot. You know, the Labour Party founded the NHS and enacted loads of things to do with sort of social security and those sorts of things. And traditionally, if you were working class, you voted for the Labour Party, and those were the sort of values and you know, things that you stood by. And people who were not working class voted for the Conservative Party, who stand for sort of small government, low tax, less regulation, etc., etc. So one of the things which I think is fascinating nowadays is how the Conservative Party in the UK has convinced working class people to vote against their own interests. Ooh, because yeah. I think social media has turned what should be like big fundamental ideas about values and what we want our society to be into 10-second sound bites and slogans, and it's sort of the bite-sized ability of everything. And so even if, you know, for example, if you look at, there isn't a current manifesto for the Labour Party because there's not a general election coming, but if you looked at the list of the things that the Labour Party would enact, I'm not necessarily a Labour supporter, I'd usually vote for the Green Party, but that's by the by. But if you looked at the list of the things that the Labour Party would do in government and the list of the things that the Conservative Party would do in government, and asked any random person which one of these things would you vote for, most people would vote for the Labour Party. But because they're not good at those slogans, 10-second sound bites, they're not silly and funky like Boris Johnson, and obviously he's a lad and everyone should like him. And I know he's on his way out, supposedly, but that's another story. Because the Labour Party are not good at the soundbiteness of politics, people don't really care about what's in the manifesto and what the actual policies are, and instead think, actually, this guy over here in the Conservative Party is the one I want to back because, oh, I can relate to him, he's funny, I enjoy listening to him. And it's turned very much into personality politics rather than politics of actually what happens. And so you do have a situation, like I say, where currently, you know, in the 2019 general election, which was the last one, there was a massive landslide for the Conservative Party in traditional working class areas of Britain, especially in England. Because as a result, you know, working class people have been convinced to vote against their own interests. And I think a big part of that, like I say, is social media and the bite-sized ability of politics and how people look at information that they're presented with.
Boris Johnson was a kind of a celebrity many years before he was prime minister, though, because he appeared on British TV kind of I don't even know what you'd call them, comedy stroke panel shows.
Yeah, like Have I Got News For You is on.
I Got News For You? Yeah, that was a big one. I don't know if he's been on Nevermind the Buzzcocks a couple of times, maybe. I'm not sure. So he was in, and at the time, he came across as kind of a funny, lovable buffoon. And I think that endeared a lot of working class people towards him. Sorry, Richard.
No, I was just saying, because of the position he was in as just the mayor of London or whatever, for most people, he was a harmless, lovable buffoon.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that kind of swayed a lot of people who wouldn't traditionally have voted for him towards him. I think he was on Have I Got News For You quite a while before he even became mayor of London as well.
Yeah.
From what I remember. Probably before you were born, Richard.
I know absolutely like diddly squat about Boris. Sounds like a guy that a lot of people love to hate.
It's like the British
probably
Trump.
Someone, yeah, that's the kind of impression I get. And someone that I probably should do a little bit more research on, except that I'm still trying to get over my modern aversion to news and politics that I kind of, you know, developed over the years. But it's interesting because the way that you guys talk about the working class voting against their own interests like that, it's interesting the ways that British and U.S. politics like overlap nearly flawlessly. I know that there's some nuances and some differences to be sure, but it's like you guys are talking about the Democratic and Republican parties and how often people vote against their own best interests without even really knowing it. And I certainly see that in the Conservative Party, obviously Republican, but I think it's more relevant to break them up into conservative and liberal. It's more accurate to the way that we're discussing things, but you have a lot of people in the Conservative Party that don't realize that they're voting against their own best interests. But interestingly enough, I even see that in liberal, like the Democrats, a lot of times when you talk about like we need to tax these people and those people this and da da da, and like trying to get more things for the lower working class, they don't always have the broader perspective of how they're hurting themselves. And I'll give you an example, like my brother being a small business owner, some of the things that the Democratic Party is pushing really harms small businesses. Well, those small businesses are employing those people who need those jobs, right? And those people that have those jobs are striving to get to a position where they could potentially either own their own small businesses or find some sort of success. Well, that kind of voting kind of puts them in a situation where they don't realize they're shooting themselves in the foot and like biting the hand that feeds, right? Because who they're really trying to attack is like that top 1% or that top 3%. But who they're really attacking with a lot of these policies is that middle, I don't know, I'd say like almost like, I don't even know what the percentage is, but the good chunk of the middle class people who are just striving day to day to keep their businesses open and just trying to make a buck, but they're the ones employing these people, right? And so it's interesting to me to see the way that politics, there's a lot of movements towards trying to get laws pushed and people into the government who are going to benefit them, sure, like with social programs or with human rights laws. And that's all really good. But then you tie on those same people are pushing agendas that's going to harm their ability to, like, for example, like when you talk about like forcing small businesses to do certain things for their employees that are so expensive that the small business now goes out of business, right? It's great that those employees need those services, but it has to be done in such a way that those businesses can also maintain their business and provide those people with jobs to begin with, right?
It's
I don't know if that makes
that,
any sense.
Because like a lot of the things that you're referring to are kind of workers' rights, aren't they? And so like, right. Whereas in the UK, we've got, as workers, so many more rights from what I understand compared to Americans. You know, we have a legally mandated number of days off a year for holidays. There's like loads of different rules in terms of like sick pay and maternity pay, paternity pay. But like all of those things have been fought against by the higher up classes, like the middle and upper classes as you know, time's gone on. But what they are protections for working class people. So, you know, it's different for me because I'm a teacher, but, you know, say if I was just working in an office and I had, say, 28 paid days leave a year, you know, that's something that is a right in the UK that's been fought against. And I think it's hard because you're right. Lots of the things that are lots of the things that we're talking about make business for your, was it your brother, sorry, or...
Just like small businesses in general.
Yeah,
you
small
know.
Businesses in general, yeah. Though, harder for them, but it's things that protect the lives of working class people, and it's things that through time have always been fought against in terms of this is going to put businesses under, you know, like raising the minimum wage, you know, doing things like that. It's going to put businesses under, it's going to do this, but people forget that if you raise the minimum wage for working class people, they've got more money to spend within the economy, which means businesses do better, and it follows on like that. And it's really easy to think of these things as, oh, well, you hit it. I'm not speaking to your brother's business specifically, but
yeah,
all these things are, yes, going to affect businesses and their turnover, cash flow, whatever. But they're also important because working class people throughout history have had to fight for rights of things. And it seems like in Britain, at least historically, that seems to have turned out better than America because, you know, I look at, whereas in America, you know, people don't even have the rights to healthcare and things like that, which now, you know, in Britain, fundamental basic rights that we, you know, take for granted almost.
I think that almost makes my point, at least, and I know that like it may have been misstated a little bit, but almost makes it stronger because that kind of stuff is exactly what I'm talking about. Like the kind of legislation that would get people protections and would get them the services they need, it would take a lot of the pressure off the businesses and put it on the government or their local, either their local government or their federal government, right? So things like universal healthcare would mean that businesses then, they can provide healthcare, but maybe aren't regulated as heavily to, right? And so there's like, and it's really, there's like a small percentage of people that are always affected, right? Like when you say, well, they're shooting themselves in the foot when they're passing or pushing for this kind of legislation, they're not harming the bigger businesses. They're not harming the people who work for larger businesses. They're harming this like sort of sliver of people that are in between, like the businesses that can't quite maintain the income, right? To cover all these different things. And then the people working for them that now have to go compete and find jobs elsewhere when those businesses close. So I get that it's sort of like a small percentage of people that are affected by this.
But could be affected really heavily, like you say, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, I also think that it does two things. One, it creates sort of that glass ceiling, right? Where it's hard to start a small business. It's also hard to be in the working class and find work outside of these large corporations. Like you almost have to go to those large corporations. I'm not saying across the board, but I'm just saying like it does limit the flexibility there. It creates like this sort of, it is hard to punch through. But then the other thing is like what you guys were saying, the protections aren't then falling on the government. They're falling on the small businesses, right? Yeah. And so where you guys have a lot of social programs and social protections kind of built into how your society is run, ours is more like it's almost like we have to fight for it tooth and nail, right? Yeah.
And I think as well historically that's why what Jilva was referring to earlier on in terms of lots of working class people have pride in being working class, I think that's where a lot of that stems from as well, isn't it? You know, that you know, upper class people who live on grand estates and have lots of family money and many properties and portfolios and this, that and the other have never really had to work to get to that point. They might say they do, but they don't. Whereas lots of the things that we do take for granted nowadays have been fought for constantly through decades and centuries. And I think that's where a lot of that, like say, working class pride does come from in terms of, you know, it's not just, you know, we're proud of being working class because we work for our money. It's that there is that historical element to it as well.
So I alluded to, we're coming up to the end of the show, so I alluded at the start of the show about an interaction I had with an upper class person once. I'll to briefly tell you that story now. I was drafted in, I don't know if any of our listeners know, but I play bass guitar and I was drafted in a few years ago, well, many years ago, to do a gig. So I had to go and just kind of turn up, learn a bunch of songs with a bunch of guys I didn't really know. And then I was just carted off down to Oxford to do a gig for some upper class people. And it went really well. And I was talking to some of them after, and we were getting on like a house on fire. In fact, I was talking to one guy for over an hour, and we had a really, really good conversation, and we were getting on like long-lost friends until the point where he turned to me and asked me what university I'd been to. And at that time, this is many years ago, I'd not been to university. I'd not even entertained the thought of going to university. So I said, I've not been to university, mate. To which his response was, and I kid you not, literally, oh. And he then turned around and walked off. And literally ended. And that is literally the only negative experience I have had with an upper class person in my life. But it was a very profound and kind of memorable one as well.
So if we had more time on this episode, it would be neat to delve into those kinds of interactions, because that is really interesting. Like, you can make these generalizations of the kinds of people who are in the working class, the kinds of people who are middle class, and the kinds of people who are upper class, and there's going to be times where you're wrong. But there are these sort of like stereotypical behaviors among the different people in different classes that sort of define, in our like cultural imagination, define what that class really means. And he is a good example of that. Not that he was specifically stereotypical, but that he had a stereotypical idea of others, right?
Yeah.
That like, if you haven't gone to university, for example, you are somehow a failure or less than him or not worth talking to, or whatever it was that he was feeling that made him just like turn and walk away without even a goodbye, right? Like, yes, that might have been somewhat stereotypical behavior in and of himself, but it also shows that he has his own concepts in mind of what a successful or worthy person to talk to looks like. And that is really, really interesting, because I wonder how often we fail to see, like, especially when you talk about social class and how it ties into politics, we can fail to even see the experience or the struggles or the humanity in the other person when we decide, you know, X person has X traits and is therefore below my notice, or just because you're rich, you are someone I actually strive against or hate just based on your social income class. Because I have seen that a lot. Lower class looking up on the upper class, like, fuck you all, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, there are some upper class people that can just fuck right the fuck off, right? Like, they're just not good people. But that doesn't mean that every single person that falls into even the top 3% is worthy of that kind of like ire just automatically based on their social class. So it's interesting to think about where that discussion could go.
No, and I would like to clarify that I have met a lot of upper class people who are very, very nice as well. And he was the exception as opposed yeah. to the kind of rule. But we do have stories in Britain. I don't know if Laura's heard about these. I'm sure Richard has. Of one came out that potentially our ex-Prime Minister David Cameron may have been involved in a situation like this, where in the kind of old boys clubs in the universities and things, it's kind of a thing to stand in front of homeless people and burn money. And so that kind of behaviour does exist. It's not something I've ever come across. That was the closest I had ever got to experiencing something like that in kind of real life. And I don't know, have you heard of stuff like that going off?
Yeah, definitely. And I think what Laura said was interesting in terms of, and I've been guilty of it myself, you know, thinking worse of people by default because of my perception of what their class is, and thinking, oh, well, that's very middle class of you to do, and thinking of that almost in a reverse snobberish kind of way, if that makes any sense. Yeah, you do hear stories of those sorts of things all the time, like you were saying, Jill, especially within the, I don't know, we talk about the ruling class, don't we? But that's not necessarily a socioeconomic class. But, you know, those people who have studied, you know, Oxford and gone to these private schools and now all happen to be Conservative Party ministers or, you know, people in the House of Lords. But yeah, you certainly do hear things like that. And it, to me, speaks less of, because social class, yeah, like you were saying, Laura, has to do with income, but it also is to do with values. And I see working class people generally, and this again is a stereotype, but I see working class people generally as people who give a bit of a shit about other people more so than it's almost like there's a sliding scale of empathy that goes like that. You know, the higher the class, the less empathy
yeah.
you have. And that's certainly not true of everybody by any means. But I think often when you've got less, you've got more to give almost.
I think you also can appreciate the suffering of others when you're suffering yourself. Mm. I know it's a little bit cliche, and that's not to suggest that wealthy people never suffer, but yeah. I think it's a different kind of suffering when you're talking about that day-to-day strife of where is my next paycheck going to come from and how am I going to cover the bills?
Okay, right. So we've had a lot to say. It's been an interesting show. We've got a lot. I'm sure we've got a lot more to say. We are coming up to the end. So quick final thoughts.
My final thoughts are that there's way too much to talk about on this subject for just a 40-minute video. So there's things that we didn't even touch on. But social class really, really, really informs not only how we feel about ourselves and our level of success or where we fit into the social stratification, but how we view others. And so I would be fascinated to take this to Facebook and kind of suss out how people feel about, like, so you have the upper class that's like, well, don't mess with us and our money. We're the ones that are creating your guys' jobs. And then you have the lower class that are like, we want the same care and stuff as you guys have. Where's the middle ground? That's my question. Is there a compromise to be made? And I'll pass it off to you guys because I know we're running up.
Take it to Facebook, and we are all working class, so please go to our merch store as well. Richard.
And I was just going to say it's been a really interesting conversation, and I think it's allowed some good skeptical introspection on sort of my own thoughts and hang-ups about class and thinking about other people as well. But yeah, certainly, like Jill ever said, give us money.
All right. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget to keep questioning.
Interrogate your beliefs.
That's my line, Gilliver.
You should have been faster.
Stay skeptical. We got to end this. We got to sail this or put this ship to shore. All right. Bye, all.